This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Mike Pesca in Washington. Neil Conan is away. These 5 days between votes in Iowa and New Hampshire are kind of a political Mardi Gras. The crews of Clinton, Obama, Romney, McCain, they're the hottest tickets in town. And we, the voters, are drunk on a hurricane of attack ads and poll numbers. But wait a minute and take a step back. Put down the beads, because we are engaging in a sobering process. On February 5th, Super Duper Tsunami Tuesday, more of us will be asked earlier than ever to help pick a party nominee for president. And how do we do that? I mean, really, the surges in the polls suggest that a lot of people are being swept up in a wave. Is that it? Are we that impressionable? How do we, as voters, really decide? Later on, we'll talk about the broken campaign promises that broke our hearts. But first, when it comes to voting, what is it? Is it issues? Is it character? Or do we just vote on the cut of the candidate's jib? Give it some thought and join the conversation. Tell us how you make up your mind. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You could also comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us with one view on how voters decide is Ann Mack. She's director of trend spotting for the advertising agency JWT. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
Trend spotting. Ooh, that's a cool title.
Thank you.
What's the trend in how voters are deciding, and is it really a trend?
Well, voters decide based on a couple of things, primarily rational and emotional triggers, but right now they are going with their emotions. That's why candidates are throwing around the word change so frequently following Barack's win in Iowa.
Now, when you say right now they're going with their emotions, do you mean the ones that based on purely or mostly intellectual means they've already made up their minds?
To an extent, some people are weighing the pros and the cons and the assets and liabilities and the baggage that these candidates carry with them, and then they'll make a decision. But quite frequently, they'll go to the polls, cast their ballot, and then post-rationalize their behavior by talking about the issues.
As a matter of fact, I think a lot of polling shows that when you ask people afterwards, not only do they post-rationalize behavior, they sometimes convince themselves that they actually voted for the winner. Post hoc, the polls show that the winner got a much higher percentage of votes than he ever or she ever really did.
Yes, definitely.
And so what kinds of questions do you ask? How do you figure out how people make up their minds there at your advertising agency?
Well, as brand experts, we believe it's imperative for leaders in the spotlight and politicians especially to manage their personal brand. And to that end, we've been asking a number of questions to get at what people perceive are their assets and liabilities, what their associations are, both positive and negative. In our most recent survey, we asked questions designed to determine the extent to which the candidates' families, their relationships with them, and their religious affiliations affect voters' decisions.
So who do you ask the questions to? A focus group of potential voters?
We have an online panel of 80,000-some people that we reach out to, 18 and older, and do this on a fairly regular basis.
And do you ask them about issues also?
We have not gone to the issue point yet because those issues aren't as clearly defined yet.
Oh, so you think that is this what the campaigns are trying to do, define the people before they define the issues?
Well, I think they're trying to reach out to a number of people because there are still so many undecideds out there. You see in New Hampshire, Barack, McCain, and Clinton trying to reach those independent voters and trying to get them to sway their way.
And you think that, but what you're saying is through all your research, people are responding to the emotional, the who the person is, rather than what the person says. Would your research be able to pick up if it were otherwise?
Later research will pick up on that, but let's face it, the Democrats tend to stand for some of the same issues, that being universal health care, a withdrawal from the war in Iraq. The Republicans also stand for some of the same issues, but the difference is they're in their approaches. A lot of people would be hard pressed to tell you what their approaches are just yet.
Mm. Megan from Syracuse, New York. Hi, Megan.
Hello.
How are you? How do you decide about who you're going to vote for?
I know this may seem a little boring, but I decide based on the issues. I decide what's the biggest, most important issue for me, and that's got the most weight. And then I go on down the line and kind of decide who matches my viewpoints the best, and I vote for that person. And
what is the biggest issue for you this election?
I'd have to say healthcare, and I'd have to disagree with your guest in that I don't think, as a Democrat, that all the Democratic candidates are the same, as in for universal healthcare. Not all the plans proposed are universal. I'm personally going to vote for Hillary Clinton. Her plan is universal and has some good features to prevent the cost of the insurance from exceeding a certain percentage of anyone's income.
Issue-wise,
Obama doesn't have a universal plan.
That's Barack Obama. Issue-wise, what's the difference between Hillary Clinton and John Edwards?
Well, John Edwards on the health care issue and Hillary Clinton are very similar. They have different perspectives on other issues. I happen to think that Hillary Clinton is more focused on women and children and family issues than John Edwards is, and that John Edwards is a little more focused on maybe fighting corporate America or the battle for the little guy, the common worker.
But still issues when deciding between...
A little bit more with the former, I'm leaning that way.
But so even when deciding between Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Edwards, it's still issues
it's
for you.
It's still issues.
All right. Well, thanks very much for the call, Megan. And so, Anne, is Megan unusual?
Well, again, I think that a lot of people would be hard-pressed to define the issues in the way that Megan just laid them out. And whenever I make blanket statements like the Democrats stand for the same things, you're always going to caveat it with one or two people who slightly differ. But, you know, I think people are still trying to determine who stands for what and go deeper into how they stand on the issues. And again, it's the all in the approach and how they differ from one candidate to the other.
On the line with us is Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor. Hey, Ron, how are you?
I'm not too bad, and I'm glad to be with you, Mike.
Well, it's good to have you. You're up there in Manchester, New Hampshire.
Yes, I am, and in what is not quite sunny, but remarkably warm, Manchester, New Hampshire.
Well, you'll take it. Maybe it's a little different from New Hampshire primaries in the past. But, you know, I don't have to tell you, Ron, that you know that John F. Kennedy's father said that he was going to sell his son like a box of soap flakes, I think is the quote. Has a lot changed since that election when Joe Kennedy was talking about his son like he was a product?
Well, the marketing aspect of politics has only become more intense since Joe Kennedy's day. Of course, at that point, television was just coming into its own and had not yet come to campaign dominance. But of course, since then, it has become the principal instrument by which all political candidates at this level disseminate their views and contest with other candidates. So television runs the show. A lot of people, I think, feel that our entire presidential nominating and electing process has essentially become a long-running TV reality show.
Do you think that the campaigns themselves, if in a moment of honesty, would they tell you what we have to do is position a candidate who the people like the most as a person, or would they tell you what we have to do is think about a set of issues that the people will respond to the best?
Normally, you would get an intense argument, a pitched battle over that very question, but not right now, because in this 24, 48, 72-hour period, we are seeing one of those phenomena that comes along every so many decades in American politics, where a particular individual, for a certain period of time, very hard to predict how long it will be, captures the imagination of a large proportion of the voters, at least in a few states in the primary process. Whether or not it'll be a national phenomenon is yet to be seen. But Barack Obama is ripping through New Hampshire, much the way he did in the final days of the Iowa campaign, and vastly increasing the number of people who would consider voting for him tomorrow in the primary, or consider voting for him in November for president, or just be able to imagine him being president.
And is he a collection of issues, or is he a cut-of-his-jib type appeal to his candidacy?
Well, with all respect to his views on the issues, and I'm not saying he hasn't many views on many issues and plans and proposals for things to do, but that's not the sum of his candidacy. In fact, his candidacy is all about transcending that sort of talk and transcending the kind of laundry list of things that you want to do and change that most politicians like to rely on or tend to rely on, and instead offering something that is, well, it's more music than it is prose. It's more a kind of almost mysterious appeal to some portion of people that is not entirely rational. Now, that's not said in a lack of respect for the rational aspects of Barack Obama's campaign. The man is a trained lawyer. He's a United States senator. He can make a rational argument. But what he is doing on the stump right now that's making him a phenomenon goes well beyond that.
All right. Let's see what – here's another perspective. I think Veronica from Kensington, California. Are you there?
I'm here.
How do you make up your mind, Veronica?
You know, I have to agree with your guest today. It's completely a gut feeling reaction for me, particularly being a woman. For me, that's all I see. The importance of electing a woman president transcends every issue.
Would you say no matter what woman were running, or this particular woman, Hillary Clinton, embodies it for you?
Yes, absolutely. And I think I've been surprised at how little that's been spoken to. I mean, the breaking the glass ceiling is of utmost importance, and that to me is unprecedented.
All right. Thanks for the call, Veronica. So, Ron Elving, you have someone there who wants to vote for a woman. Have you heard explicitly people saying, I want to vote for a black candidate or a candidate of mixed race like Barack Obama is?
Maybe not so much in Iowa and New Hampshire, where the population of people who are non-white is quite small. But I think there will be people who, in the course of these primaries, want to vote for Barack Obama based on his racial background. I do agree with the caller. I am surprised that there has not been more discussion of the importance for women, for the history of women in America, the history of women in all world politics, of the notion that the Democrats have come quite close, have had a front runner for months, who is a woman and who is bidding fair to become the first woman president of the United States. That got a lot of attention around the world. And if she does stumble in these early events, and if she is frustrated in her effort to become president, many people will see that in terms of sexual politics, gender politics.
Okay, hang on, Ron. Hang on, Ann. With the New Hampshire primary right around the corner, we are talking about how people actually make up their minds on Election Day. Let us know what you're thinking. We're taking your calls at 800-989-8255 or send us an email at talk@npr.org. I'm Mike Pesca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Mike Pesca in Washington. You've heard a lot about candidates wooing undecided voters, and you could follow their efforts in the final day before the New Hampshire primaries with a video on our website, npr.org. But what actually pushes an undecided to decide? We're talking about the mysterious chemistry that goes into that moment of truth this hour. My guests are NPR's senior Washington editor Ron Elving and Ann Mack. She's the director of trend spotting at the advertising agency JWT. And of course, we want to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. And Ann Mack, you heard from a few callers who took umbrage at the offense that anything other than issues would make them decide. And what I want to know is, when you explicitly ask something, is it issues or people, do you get a different answer than the different ways of polling that you have of getting at that conundrum, the person versus the politics?
Yes, actually, we ask them what they think their actions would be, and then we also ask them what they think the other actions of other people will be, and usually it lies somewhere in between. I'll give you an example. We had asked a question about whether spouses, a candidate's spouse, would enter into their decision about who they would vote for. Well, a whopping 77% said they believe it had played into other people's votes, but a minority said it didn't play into their own. So what does it mean? It means that likely their real actions fall somewhere in between.
Yeah, it's sort of like the question, are you affected by negative ads? No. Are other people? Oh, yeah, sadly
so. Of course. So somewhere in between, that's where the truth lies.
Rebecca in Brattleboro, Vermont, so maybe she's crossed state lines to check out a primary event, writes, it seems as though voters will vote for whoever appears nicest. They don't want fighting. The guy you'd want to have a beer with, the most inspirational, seems to win. This is also why Congress's approval rating is so low. People hate watching sausage being made. Ron Elving, what about that nice factor?
You know, this is one of the real mysteries to me about this process, because we know for certain, because we've seen it so many times, that negative advertising works. But people don't want to be reminded that it works. They don't like to see it in process. They don't want to watch people fight. But they will definitely change their votes. We've seen it again and again when negative information about a candidate is conveyed to them by negative ads.
Do you think
television ads, flyers, the works.
Ron, do you think it's the manner of conveying it? I asked that because I was watching the ABC Republican debate the other night, and Mitt Romney made a reference to his stance, and Mike Huckabee, who's a funny guy, came in with which stance, meaning that Mitt Romney has had a couple of them, and it got a chuckle from the audience. Now, if that had been said in a different way or with a sneer, maybe people would chafe at the Mike Huckabee message.
I think Huckabee has gotten away with a good deal of counterpunching by couching it in humor and by essentially portraying it as counterpunching. In other words, I'm simply defending myself when I call you a flip-flopper who's dishonest and doesn't tell the truth to the voters, that sort of thing. At the same time, when you're doing it in a campaign commercial, it really has a kind of art to it. You need to be effective and get the point across without being too nasty. And, of course, with the law change that requires each candidate to identify himself or herself at the end of each ad, you're not going to be able to slip this ad by without people realizing that it's the work of your campaign.
Chris from Louisville, Kentucky. Welcome to the conversation, Chris.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Go right ahead.
You know, I'm really disappointed at Ms. Max, the way that she describes this process. I feel like I'm listening to somebody plan a campaign to sell laundry detergent. When she talks about the candidate's brand, I think that what that does is that whole process cheapens the political process. That's not to say that I don't think it's effective. I do think it's effective, but I think it's very unfortunate.
And Mac, what do you have to say to that?
Well, it is called a campaign for a reason, and it is building their brands along the duration of this campaign. There is a reason why a number of the candidates are changing their messaging in the days leading up to New Hampshire. It's because they see that Barack Obama's messaging worked. So they're doing it about face, and Hillary Clinton, for instance, is no longer emphasizing experience. She's emphasizing change. Mitt Romney is emphasizing the idea that Washington is broken. They are definitely glomming on to the idea of change.
Yeah, and I think, again, she's using the same kind of terminology when she says something like messaging. I want to know what somebody's position is. You know, I think that one of the problems is, you know, and I wasn't a supporter of either Joe Biden or Chris Dodd, but those are the two most experienced guys in the Democratic race. And instead, the front runner is Barack Obama. And the thing that I know most about him is I know the least about him. And I really don't know if I would vote for him or not. I live in Kentucky, so we're not really a player in this whole primary process. So I haven't had to make up my mind. But some of the things that he said bother me. Some of the things he says I agree with, but he doesn't have the record. He's the one we're least able as voters to predict how he's going to act in the future because he has the shortest track record. And I think that treating this whole thing like, a soap commercial is harmful for the process. And I think that's exactly why we are where we are, and I think it's harmful.
All right. Well, thanks very much for the call there, Chris. And let's go to Nathan in Durango, Colorado.
Yeah, right here.
Hi there, Nathan. Go right ahead.
All right. I just wanted to say I agree with one of your callers earlier that I think issues are an absolutely essential part of the process, and I look at the issues. However, I feel like our country is in a state that a charismatic and inspirational leader is somebody that we really need so that we can get behind somebody that we can love, somebody like JFK. And I definitely think that in terms of issues, we go to somebody in our community and look for somebody that's really digging down to the core of the issues. It's difficult for people like me who are a parent to get all the information necessary to determine how the issues are going. And so I'm really looking at charisma right now.
Well, do you worry that a sufficiently or an overly charismatic candidate can sort of fool you on his stance on the issues?
Absolutely. And that's where the issues come in to kind of help us get behind somebody fully. I don't want to see somebody. I don't think that our country's in the position to watch somebody that's going to be dry and difficult to love and get behind. I think that we need somebody that we can truly love, and that's where I think the issues are going to come in as backup. and we need to go to our community members that we really trust and look up to in terms of digging down to the core of the issues and ask them who they think is somebody that we can truly support when it comes to health care, Iraq war, et cetera.
Okay, thanks very much for the call there, Nathan. And Ron Elving, any reaction to that?
I want to endorse what Chris, the earlier caller from Kentucky, was saying. I think he really eloquently laid out the challenge to our process that the television, and I really do believe it is the medium of television that has done this,
and you don't say
posed.
That just because you're a radio professional?
Well, radio was doing its part and would have probably been as effective, but television just had this enormous power for a number of decades where people were getting very little political message anyplace else. Sure, they looked at the newspaper. Maybe they looked at the newspaper endorsement, but it did not have the power to get across what the candidates stood for and how they did it, their manner, their personality that television had. Now we're moving into another media age in which television is just one arrow in a quiver of many ways that a candidate can try to reach the voters, and I think that's a good thing. Now, with respect to whether or not we're going to see the effects of that in this particular vote, in this particular election, I think we're seeing a charisma election right now. Mm-hmm. It has things in common with JFK. And when the caller says, yes, the issues matter, but he also wants somebody who he likes, somebody he wants to see, somebody he wants to hear from over the next 4 years, I think that's enormously powerful to the American voter, no matter what their education level, what their income level. That's one of the things we really care about.
I mean, in the current media age, aren't they all charisma elections? This is the old Abraham Lincoln have had a chance, given the current state of the media. But if you look back at all the races, doesn't the guy who seems to have more charisma, however the most Americans define it, seem to have the upper hand, at least since maybe, oh, I don't know, even Eisenhower beat Stevenson?
Yes, and I think that Ronald Reagan stands out as a kind of paragon of that. Clearly, that man had a communication skill and a connection with the average voter that transcended party, and that made a huge difference. And it reinvented the Republican Party, and it reinvented conservatism in our politics for generation, for a generation, perhaps more than a generation. We have not seen anyone else with anything approaching that kind of charisma, although Bill Clinton would be the closest thing to it over on the Democratic side. He has not yet established that he was redefining American politics in the way Ronald Reagan did. He tried. He is still trying. Now it's being done to some degree through his wife's campaign. We'll see whether or not that's ultimately successful. But I don't think it's ever fair to say that somebody who is highly charismatic is only about charisma. I don't think we've had a president who was only about charisma. Ronald Reagan stood for a lot of things. Agree or disagree, you have to say he stood for certain concepts, certain ways of seeing the world, and he made that stick.
I think as people who watch politics define charisma, charisma without substance is not charisma. But let's, you know, we've been talking about trying to get inside the head of the voter, and that is an abstract term, except for a guy like Dr. Marco Iacobone, who is a researcher at the University of California, Los Angeles, Semmel Institute for Neuroscience. Hello, Dr. Iacobone.
Hello, how are you?
And so you've done some looking inside the head of voters literally, is that right?
That's right.
What do you see?
Well, we did an experiment with brain imaging. That was done in September, and that's something to keep in mind because things changed quite a bit in this campaign in the last few months.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did was to take voters that are called swing voters because they have not made up their mind. They're open to choose a candidate from either party. And we showed them a series of pictures of the major candidates from all parties. But again, keep in mind that we did this in September. So, for instance, we didn't choose any picture from Huckabee because at that time he wasn't considered a major candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And now he is. And we used brain imaging, and so we looked into their brains while they were looking at these pictures.
And what are you looking? What parts of the brain are you looking to see if they light up?
Well, we can look at the whole brain, but certainly some brain regions are more important than others. So, for instance, when we looked at, the other thing we did was to ask questions about what they felt about the candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing we found was that, for instance, when our voters were looking at the pictures of Hillary Clinton, it turns out that the voters that rated Clinton lowly, they had low ratings for Clinton, had activity in this brain region that is often associated with conflict, internal conflict. So we interpreted that as suggesting that the people that give low ratings to Clinton, they don't feel too good about that.
Mm-hmm. You mean that they themselves are conflicted about giving the low rating, or she makes them feel conflicted?
Well, they feel conflicted themselves.
Okay, so they feel bad to give her a low rating.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. What about some of the other candidates?
Well, another thing that we found was that, you know, these are swing voters, and it's you can see that also they have swing brains in a way, because the way we did the experiment, we had first we showed the pictures, then we showed them a little stump speech from each candidate, and then we showed them the pictures again, and we want to see whether there is a difference in the activity of the brain before and after watching the video.
Okay.
And what we found, for instance, was that Giuliani, what it shows is that in our men voters, swing voters, Giuliani had a very strong response in the brain of male voters before the speech, but much less after the speech. In women, it was the opposite. Giuliani shows that there is very little response in women's brains before the speech, but after the speech, there is a much stronger response.
Uh-huh. And if I don't know if any political consultants have asked you to give them advice, but is there any advice that you could give based on what you've seen by watching people's brains?
Well, it's really hard to say. I mean, one thing that was interesting was that when we, again, this was in September, and when we did the study in September, what we found was that, for instance, Barack Obama had, in our female subject, it showed no response whatsoever. Remember, at that point, Barack's campaign was probably at the lowest point of the campaign. Mm-hmm. And since then, it really changed the tone of the campaign, and you can see the difference that it made. So in a way, yeah, you can use brain imaging to give some advice to candidates and consultants, because it seems that what we saw in the brain at that point really reflected what was going on in the campaign.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News, and I want to throw it to Ron Elving. This brain imaging, do you know if the campaigns are aware of this sort of research that are going on?
I imagine some of the people within the campaigns are somewhat familiar with some of the literature and would love to make use of it, but I think it's probably some distance yet away from practical application for them.
And do you think that candidates themselves would say, no way am I just going to say the things that light up certain parts of people's brains? That doesn't that doesn't fit my definition of what being authentic is?
Possibly, but I think politicians are also inclined to say things that make the part of people's heads known as their mouths turn upward. And we've seen this over and over and over when a politician is talking to a group of people and one line is not working. He'll work for another, look for another, keep pushing until he finds the line that does light up the faces he's looking at, does bring those smiles, does show him bright eyes, and, of course, eventually applause. But you're watching the face. You're watching the face, and when those faces light up, that's the issue, that's the line, that's the message you want to send.
It's like a comedian working his act out on the road before being booked at the big room at Caesars. Karen from Vermont, you have a comment. Go ahead, Karen.
Yes, thanks for taking my phone call.
You are welcome.
I'm an African-American woman. I've been living in Vermont for a while, and I was talking to my mother on the phone. She's from Philadelphia, and we were talking about the candidates in the race and who she was going to vote for, who I was going to vote for, and I asked her if she thought the country was ready for a black president, and her response was that she thought they would elect a black man before they would ever elect a woman, which took me by surprise. I'd have to say, if I was felt more of an affinity towards any group, it's probably more towards being a female than it is towards my race. And I was really highly supportive of Hillary Clinton's campaign because I thought Bill Clinton did a wonderful job as president, and I also thought that she tried to tackle the health care issue in this country as first lady, which I think is a debacle and needs work. However, I'm unsure that the way she's running her campaign, if she's going to have a chance to get the nomination, and that it's raised my awareness, and it is a concern.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks for that call, Karen. And in the couple minutes that we have left, Ann Mack, anything that you heard from the callers today, either what they were saying about how they make up their minds or their concerns, anything new to you?
Well, I'm not surprised that your callers would definitely be listening with a keen ear to the issues, more so than the general population, because they are probably well-versed in politics. But at the same time, I do think that emotion plays into our decision making, just as it does in our decision making when we go to the store. And I know that caused an uproar to liken politicians to products, but they are marketing themselves much in the same way we market products.
Okay, Ann Mack, trend spotter for JWT, thank you. Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor, thank you. And Dr. Marco Iacoboni, thank you all very much. Coming up, it's Talk of the Nation opinion page. We've got Joseph Ellis about politicians and promises. I'm Mike Pesca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.